Welcome back, everyone, to the Retro Computing Roundtable, Show 12. The RCR is a show about computer history and nostalgia by computer historians, hobbyists, and collectors. Today, we really have a jam-packed edition. I'm David Grealish, and I'm your host today. I'm in Johns Creek, Georgia. I also read the Stan Veit's History of the Personal Computer audiobook podcast, and sometimes do a classic computing video podcast. So next on, we also have Carrington Vanston, who hails from Toronto, Ontario, Canada.
Heyo!
He's the host of 1 Megahertz, the Apple II podcast, or a Apple II podcast, and co-host of the Double Take podcast. Hey, Carrington.
Hello.
How's it going?
It's going excellently. How are you?
Good. A busy past 3 weeks?
It has been. Well, personally, yes. I've started taking an improv class. So
oh, yeah.
I'm really enjoying that, my first little comedy class. So it's
excellent.
Been fun.
Mm-hmm.
Is that bringing you out of your shell?
You're not allowed to talk yet. We haven't introduced you. You can't talk. You must be quiet and in the background.
Back on mute.
Well, as acting host, since we haven't got to Earl yet, we can banter. And so it's great that you mentioned that, Carrington, because I'm actually about to sign up for a comedy workshop myself.
Oh, fabulous.
Here in the Atlanta area. It's not an improv class. I think it's interesting because I haven't called and talked to them yet. They offer an introduction to comedy acting, and then they have an introduction to comedy writing. But it seems like both include the other somewhat. So,
sure. I know, but I'm taking mine at a school called Bad Dog Theater. And there's also The Second City, very famous. And
Oh, yeah.
And they have comedy writing classes as well. I think you have to normally take an improv class first, and then you can get into comedy writing. I'm interested in that, too. So I'm thinking of also signing up for Second City.
Oh, man. I'm a huge fan of The Second City. Mm-hmm. And, of course, SCTV, you know, as an American. Well, of course, I know there's one in Chicago. But my introduction to Second City was because of people coming onto Saturday Night Live and then the SCTV and stuff.
Right.
Considering I never lived in Chicago. Actually, I recently met an actress, which I'll talk about on a little movie project I was involved in, and she was in the Toronto Second City troupe for a little while.
Oh, fantastic.
As a young actress. So, okay, cool. So, yeah, so, you know, I'm interested in comedy, too.
So who was that other fellow who spoke?
Oh, so let's introduce Earl Evans. He's from Portland, Oregon, and the host of the RetroBits podcast.
Hey, guys.
How's it going?
That's good to be back.
We thought we'd have you back on.
Excellent.
Anything new with you, Earl? You've been real busy.
Yeah, I mean, lots of retro stuff going on, which I'll talk about, you know, a little bit later. But just in general, yeah, busy. Things are really going well. Happy that it's summer. Got blue skies, you know, not raining here in Portland. So also, my kids were away at camp for a week. Now
lucky you.
Yeah, well, you know, nice to have a little time off, but of course, you know, toward the end, you're going, why didn't he call? Why didn't he call? Yeah, oh, I didn't have cell phone reception. You know, but...
Hello, mother. Hello,
exactly.
Father.
It's funny, because he was at a place called Camp Magruder, and every time I heard that, I was thinking Camp MacGruber.
Did they have a good time?
That had a great time, but now they're home. Good to have them home. So, in fact, I took my daughter with me last night to the Commodore Computer Club meeting that we had in Vancouver, Washington, and she had a great time. She was showing off some of the stuff she was doing with Turtle Graphics, and it was fun to just, you know, have her along. So, yeah, things are good.
That's cool. It'd be great to see, you know, this just a side topic here real quick is, have you thought about like filming her? And then this raises the question, like, would you be comfortable posting that on YouTube? Cause I've thought about this before, like bringing my kids into it. And then I'm like, well, do I really want to put video of my kids up on YouTube or something, you know?
Yeah. I know that's a question from an audio perspective. I've always been comfortable with it.
Yeah.
If you go back in the back catalog on RetroBits, there's episodes where Joshua, my
I remember.
Son,
mm-hmm. and playing Zork, I think.
Yeah, exactly. We were doing Zork and you know, another one where we were playing Star Raiders on the Atari 800.
Nice.
And so, you know, that's cool. You know, on video, I got to think that through. I don't know. It's a good question, David. You know, I mean, they're getting to an age now where it's probably fine. You know, Jessica's 12, Joshua's 13 going on 14. So I think at that point, and plus my son and his buddy have put other video stuff that they've done up on YouTube. So
yeah.
I guess if they're comfortable putting themselves up there, then I'm comfortable with it. So yeah, good thought though.
Yeah, I've thought about it. Like my youngest is 8, and I've thought about maybe doing like what you had done, and maybe getting him to play on some old games and stuff. But then I had you know briefly debated about, oh, maybe, wait, do I really want to do video though and put that up? But anyway, so let's move along. And Earl, I'm going to immediately come back to you for our first topic because you were there. So we're talking about the first Seattle Retro Computing Society meeting. I guess that was what, last Saturday?
It was last Saturday. You know, we went up from Portland. A group of about a dozen people got together up in Seattle at the Living Computer Museum, which is owned and operated by Paul Allen and his staff. And we had a little meeting about vintage computing. A bunch of people brought their vintage computers, and we set them up on tables. And, you know, if you can imagine like a little mini vintage computer festival, if you will, but without formal presentations and that kind of thing. There were lots of cool microcomputers there. There's an Apple I reproduction that was an actual reproduction of the circuit board, and you know, went out and got the original chips and everything under
and like not from a modern kit, a complete reproduction.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And you can see pictures of a lot of this, and I think, David, you're going to have that link up in the show notes, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
There was Atari, Commodore, IBM, Epson, and even a BBC Master, which is, you know, one of those European systems that you don't often get to see stateside, but that was up and running. It was cool to see it in operation. And then, you know, to top all this off and the good chat and pizza and that kind of thing, there was also a tour of some of the artifacts that are there at the Living Computer Museum. Keith, who was hosting us and is a member of the staff there, took us around and showed us things like the PDP-10 mainframe, the PDP-8, the PDP-11, which I really enjoyed seeing from, you know, that reminded me of my college days when I actually cut my teeth on a lot of programming on that machine. But, you know, these things, they don't just have them there. They actually have them up and running, and they can demo how they work. We got to see things like a super loud but very fast high-speed line printer that would connect up to the mainframe, and also a gigantic disk pack. You know, it's not a thumb drive. It's more like a body drive because it took your whole body to carry this 200 megabytes around gigantic platters. But overall, it was good chat.
That's what that big plug is, too, that goes to that? Is that what that's connected to or no?
I think that goes to a different machine. Don't quote me on this. I think that may have actually gone to a completely different set of hardware. But, if you're looking at that picture, see that gigantic plug there that they jokingly called USB 0.1. But just the scale of all this stuff, you know, is so much bigger. And it was interesting that at least the stuff that we saw was not – that was part of Paul Allen's collection that we were seeing is not – you know, microcomputers, is these big minis and mainframes and,
iron, yeah.
The stuff you wish you had the money to collect and actually run, but we don't, but he does. Mm-hmm. And so he did, and it was great to see it. And like I say, good pizza, good chat. We had a great time. And thanks to Gordon for putting all this together, Gordon Steamson. He did a great job at, hosting, getting us all together. And we had a fun time.
And
what were the things that you brought, Earl?
I brought a sampling of portable computing from the early 80s and kind of showed, you know, if you wanted to do portable computing back then, what were you up against? And so some of the things were a TRS-80 Model 100, a Epson PX-8 laptop, and then, you know, getting into bigger and heavier, a Commodore SX64, and then, you know, my Goliath, the IBM PC 5155, which is like an IBM XT in a suitcase. It was IBM's answer to Compaq. It didn't really wind up competing with Compaq, but it's a very cool machine. And, you know, so.
And a heavy beast. Those things
very,
are, those
very
things
heavy,
are solid.
Yes. Yeah, there's a nice picture of your table here. And I like the IBMs. I always like the orange or amber, it was called, the amber phosphor. I always liked that versus, you know, green or white at the time.
Nine-inch amber screen, yep.
Yeah. Of those, the one that really appeals to me, though, is the Model 100. I love the Model 100. And that's the sort of thing if somebody's looking to get into retro collecting. They're readily available.
Yeah,
they're
cheap.
Relatively low cost, and you can do a lot still with them. It's a really active user base still, and you can program them, and they take very little space. So if you want to get in collecting, it's a tiny, tiny thing relative to most retro computers. So it's often what I would recommend somebody if they want to get in. Like, that's a great place to start because they are very fun and very useful and cheap to get a hold of, and there's a good
very community. Reliable too.
Yeah, and just awesome. Like, if you're gonna sit at a cafe and use something, you know, go use one of those. That's hardcore hipster.
I totally agree.
Well, that's great. I was really happy to see the Seattle group start up, because it's, you know, it's what I'm trying to do here in Atlanta, which I have a meeting, you know, right after this, our show here, I'm excited about. So and especially having it at the museum there. See, that's what we're still looking for, a place to meet. So I'm having guys here at the house. I wish I could find a museum. That would be perfect.
Mm. That looks like a great place. I really want to go there.
Absolutely appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so moving to Carrington, can you tell us more about this Toronto video game Armageddon you listed?
Yeah, so there's something that happened last Tuesday. It was the first of what appears to be a series of events called the Toronto Video Game Armageddon. And my favorite cinema here in Toronto is something called the Toronto Underground Cinema. It's absolutely fantastic rep theater. In case you're in Toronto, it's near the corner of Spadina and Queen. So it's right downtown. And it's sort of like a hidden movie theater. If you don't know it's there, you'd walk right by and not even see it, because there's like sort of a mall. You have to walk in the mall and walk right to the very back and then go down a flight of stairs. And in the basement used to be an old kung fu movie theater, because this is right in part of Toronto called Chinatown. And the Golden something, Golden Lion, Golden Dragon, some sort of golden thing it was called. And it's been closed for years. And three fellows decided they always wanted to own a cinema. And they got together, have leased it, and they're now running a rep cinema. And that itself is really interesting. They have a web series called The Rep that's sort of documenting them trying to run a movie theater. And they play new movies and old films and have fun event nights and stuff. And at this location, now more apropos for this podcast, they're now running on Tuesday evenings something called the Toronto Video Game Armageddon, where in the cinema, they hook up a projector and people get together and they play video games in the theater. But what's interesting is it's only retro video games. This first evening was a Nintendo 64, and it's all going to be just completely old video game systems. And everybody comes by. It's only a couple of bucks for the evening, and they try to have mostly head-to-head games. And so it might be Super Smash Brothers, I think, was one of the games they featured last Tuesday. And you just get up and playing, and as soon as you die, then the next person in line steps up and they grab the controller. And so it's just a big sort of party evening with retro video games. My intent is to head down there hopefully next Tuesday or the one after, and interview the guys and get a sense of the space and what's going on there. And maybe I'll have some audio for it going forward. Unfortunately, sort of strangely, I know this event happened because a lot of people are discussing online about how much fun it was, but the actual event page for it on Facebook is now down. So I don't know what that means for it going forward, but we'll see. But it did happen last Tuesday, and according to the Toronto Underground Cinema site, which is torontounderground.cinema.com, it looks like it will be going forward in the future as well. So we'll see. But it looks like a really fun time for retro gaming enthusiasts to sort of gather in a place and have some popcorn and play.
I did add that link. So if you look, the link here is to the Toronto Underground Cinema site, which is mentioning – you know, so it's saying next showing for this on Tuesday, July 5th at 6 p.m.
Right.
Talking about the video. So I added that link at least for right now.
And it's just sort of three guys running it, and they run an amazing cinema, but they don't always update their schedule. You'll go to the website and they'll say nothing is playing, and you'll go by the place and they'll say, no, we're having this tonight. And like they sort of run it a little loose, and they do fun events. Like once a month they'll have it's a mystery movie where they have a massive collection of old films, and they pick one at random without even looking, and then that's what they play. So you go there, nobody knows what you're going to see. And they have one Sunday a month where they play old like home videos and old B movies on video cassette, and just a weird assortment of things. And they
that's
have
great.
Trailer nights, and they have sing along nights, and just and shadow casts and all that kind of stuff.
And more
really, really fun place.
You know, having knowing you, now. And like I say, I met an actress recently who had lived in Toronto, from Toronto originally. She's been in the Atlanta area like 18 years. But now where I work, we have an office in Toronto. And so I work with a couple of people. It just seems like Toronto is such a cool place.
It
I mean, the
is.
More I hear about it, there's a lot of, it's just a great place. So I want to mention, Carrington, it's kind of cool, too, that you are so interested in movies. You know, you have this tie to movies, and now this movie theater has a thing about retro computing and stuff, gaming. It kind of all ties in pretty nicely.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it works very well for me that my favorite cinema is also now doing retro video games. These guys are really catering to me as a specific demographic.
And it makes great sense. It's entertainment. And actually, not to get carried away with this topic, but modern video gaming is kind of moving, you know, they're kind of merging a little bit more, I would, you know what I mean, movies and games to a certain extent.
Sure. UE Ball just turns all video games into movies, so yeah. But anyway, it looks like a fun event. So people that are in the Toronto area on Tuesday evenings with nothing to do, it looks like something to come by, just a couple of bucks, and get a party atmosphere and play some retro video games. Looks fun.
Well, excellent. All right, so next up we're going to talk about the Retro Challenge 2011 Summer Challenge. that's the way it's stated. So basically today's July 2nd, so this started yesterday. It officially started July 1st, and it runs until the end of the month, July 31st. I'm not involved. I've always wanted to be. I always mean to be. I know if you look at their rules and prizes and stuff, you can join anytime you want. It's not really an official sort of contest. Are either of you doing anything for it or plan to? I think you are, Earl, right?
I'm taking another crack at getting my PX8 drive emulator working.
And you did the last one, the winter warm-up.
I did, yeah. And it's fun to participate. You can do just pretty much about anything with retro computing. And you can go to retrochallenge.net, which I'm sure we'll have up in the show notes for more information. It's a fun activity. Also, you can subscribe to their Twitter feed.
Yeah, so I think I'm going to really try, you know, get this show out and some other stuff I'm behind on. And then I think I might... in a week or see if I can't participate on some level. Oh, okay, so retrochallenge.net if it goes to this other site that I linked to. Carrington, you going to do anything? Try to?
I keep wanting to, and my schedule always gets so full. I have a thing called a Smith Corona Messenger module that I picked up ages ago that I've been dying to get working. And it's a very specific and weird bit of technology from the 80s where a series of Smith Corona electric typewriters had a certain port in the back of them, like a proprietary parallel port. And you could use something called a messenger module that would talk between an 8-bit computer and the typewriter and send information both ways. So you could use the typewriter to type on, say, an Apple II or an old it would send it to Commodores. There's a few things. You can also turn the typewriter into a printer. So then it just becomes a letter quality printer. And it's something that not a lot of people have talked about. It doesn't seem to have been very popular. And it took me ages to track one of these things down. And I now have, I think, everything I would need to get it working with an Apple II. So I could use it as a printer. And you have to sort of feed in one sheet at a time. But it appeals to me aesthetically as for a printer. So I'd like to get that working. I plugged everything together once and it didn't do anything. So it would take a lot of effort. So it's sort of perfectly geared towards a retro challenge type thing. I just don't know if I'll have time. But that is what I would intend to do, and I intend to eventually do as one of these challenges.
Sounds cool.
I thought just it would be fun to use it to try blogging on or use it to produce something using that. I do a lot of writing, so write something and use that as the means of either input or output or something like that.
Yeah, and to me, that's kind of the spirit of the whole thing, that sort of a project. And like what you're doing too, Earl. That's the thing, is I want to try to do something along those lines. The only kind of hacking I've been doing, if you want to call it that, is more modern stuff, which, you know, we've talked about tying in the Arduino kind of stuff, which has been fun. But moving along then, so the next thing I wanted to mention, because I thought it was pretty interesting, it was mentioned in the Classic Computing CC Talk discussion list by Christian Liendo, and I put links to his, he's got a great blog too, by the way, and so I put links to those two things, plus the article. So the article was published in June of 1982, it's called Study Says Technology Could Transform Society. So again, this is
go way out on a limb there.
yeah. But it's interesting. Let me just highlight a couple of things in it. So what? 1982 is 29 years ago. So almost exactly, you know, 29 or so years ago. And so even the segments here I copied is four paragraphs. I'm not going to read all that. But anyway, let's see. Washington, June 13th, 1982. A report commissioned by the National Science Foundation and made public today speculates that by the end of this century, electronic information technology will have transformed American home, business, manufacturing, school, family, and political life. The report suggests that one-way and two-way home information systems called teletext and videotext will penetrate deeply into daily life with an effort on society as profound as those of the automobile and commercial television earlier in this century. Which, you know, I don't know if that was so surprising, but that's pretty right on, right? With the internet. Let's see. It conjured a vision at once appealing and threatening of a style of life defined and controlled by video text terminals throughout the house. As a consequence, a report envisioned this kind of American home by the year 1998. Quote, family life is not limited to meals, weekend outings, and once-a-year vacations. Instead of being the glue that holds things together so that family members can do all those other things they're expected to do, like work, school, and community gatherings, the family is a unit that does those other things, and the home is a place where they get done. Privacy issues seem posed. The report warned that the new technology would raise difficult issues of privacy and control that will have to be addressed soon to, quote-unquote, maximize its benefits and minimize its threats to society.
By which we mean Facebook.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously that hit it right on, too, that we are there are issues of these things with Facebooks and other leaks of, you know, net-based databases of our credit information. And
oh, sure. I mean, as much as I was joking, I did find it a very interesting and quite prescient article. It was neat to see how it was sort of warning people that these sorts of things, if you have technology and particularly information technology integrated very, very completely with society and a lot of information flow, that will have major resonation and major effects beyond which we could anticipate. I mean, that was sort of the general thrust of the article. And of course, that has been the case. And while it wasn't teletext and videotext that really did, it was the internet as we know it today. It's essentially the same sort of thing. So
yeah,
it was a really interesting article.
Well, here's the real gist here is that, and I think especially in 1982 when there really wasn't an internet and definitely online services were absolutely not mainstream, even to a majority of, I think, personal computer users. Yes, granted, there were BBS users and quite a bit of them, but, you know, I would say it still wasn't the dominant thing people were doing with computers in 1982. But this one sentence here says, let's see, just lost it. Okay. The study focused on the emerging video text industry formed by the marriage of two older technologies, communications and computing. It's estimated that 40% of American households will have two-way video text service by the end of the century. By comparison, it took television 16 years to penetrate 90%. So basically, you know, predicting the widespread use of the internet, you know, the net. And it goes on, so I won't talk about any more, but definitely worth reading.
It did get some things correct. I mean, it talked about how peer groups and friendships and stuff would be determined by interests and skills rather than just age and social class, like once you are meeting them remotely, and that has been the case. It talked about information brokers and information managers and appearing and that kind of stuff, which is interesting. My favorite line, though, something that didn't happen was, where is it? The extended family might be recreated if the elderly can support themselves through electronic homework, making them more desirable to have around.
Yeah, I had that as the last little quote that I thought was funny, too.
And it was interesting how just after that it talked about the idea, which didn't come to fruition, but an interesting one, about how it can affect politics.
Yeah.
Like that instead of just having a couple of parties, you can have people gathered together and they would form basically a political slate to push for something. And so it was sort of interesting that power shift has not happened. But a very, very interesting article. I would recommend that people go in. It's not huge and got lots of interesting ideas.
And it mentioned, of course, about you know, home-based shoppings, in other words, online shopping. And just
that'll never take off.
Just to mention about the political thing, I think you're right, Carrington. Here in the United States, obviously, we're dominated by two main parties, Democrats and Republicans, and that is absolutely still true. But on the other hand, I do think what they predicted is more true in the fact that you've got all these other political mindsets of I don't know, like the libertarian movement or just the Tea Party and some of the other people that are able to come together. Now, they're not like challenging the two big parties in dominance.
They can have a major political effect, though. Absolutely. And
yeah,
even things is more recently and a little more radical, things like Anonymous and LulzSec and what they've been doing, which are in it very much, you know, political activists.
Oh, and WikiLeaks.
Nice. Another good example. So, but very, very interesting article, especially to that it's looking forward from 1982 and what it got right and what it didn't get
and
right.
And my blog.
Interesting.
Have you seen the political impact? My blog. All right, moving on. How about Kansas Fest 2011 session list?
Never heard of it.
Who's responsible for this item?
Well, technically Kansas Fest is, but I posted it because Kansas Fest is coming up. In just a couple of weeks, I will be attending. I'm really looking forward to it. It'll be my second time going. And they've just listed the as of this date, I think it was the 19th or 20th or so of June, the sessions that were definitely firmly in place. Kansas Fest is interesting in that it's the attendees themselves that do the sessions. Well, there's usually a keynote speaker who's brought in and talks authoritatively about some topic or a bit of Apple history. For the most part, the sessions, it's not like going to, say, Worldwide Developer Conference, where you have a bunch of professionals and they talk to the crowd. Here it is the crowd breaks off and somebody from the crowd comes up and it's much more like TED Talks, but for vintage Apples.
Yeah,
so
I like
just
that.
Really interesting. So they got the current list of sessions, and
okay.
So just for people that are thinking of going last minute or who are attending it, lets them sort of plan their day. There's usually no or almost no overlap in sessions, so it is possible to hit everything if you want to. They go one at a time. I believe other than things like when there's a workshop. In this case, Vince Briel is going to do his A2 MP3 workshop, and I believe that sometimes the workshops overlap with sessions. So it might be that if you're doing the workshop, you might miss a session. But for the most part, as an attendee, you can hit almost everything if you want to.
Hey, look at this. They're doing a behind the scenes at Open Apple, the podcast by Mike McGinnis and Ken Gagne. I wonder if
I'm going to totally go and undermine them and
maybe you'll get to be on. You should write Ken and
I'm
Mike.
I'm actually a huge fan of Open Apple. That is a great and interesting podcast. It comes out once a month and with tons of info. Like, holy cow, if you're interested in the current goings-on of the vintage Apple II community, like, it is the go-to podcast. I mean, screw that 1 megahertz thing. Well, like, Open Apple is so good.
Oh, it sounds like you like them better than us.
Well, but when it's Apple, you guys want to keep bringing up that Commodore nonsense. I'm just here to keep that in check.
That's just Earl, man. I bleed rainbow colors.
Earl.
Somebody's got to keep you grounded in reality.
So that sounds great. You know, plus Kansas Fest, it seems it's more like a what's the word I'm looking for? It's like a whole getaway. I mean, it's not just one day or 2 days. It's a
yeah, it really goes
retreat.
Sort of like, yeah, it starts Tuesday night technically, and there's some things later on Saturday, but it really is a Wednesday to Friday night and then early Saturday sort of deal. But it's multiple days. They call it Summer Camp for Geeks, and that's exactly the feel when you're there. It's absolutely hilariously, wonderfully fun.
Okay, well, next we're going to move to see another just a news topic. It's called the Viva Amiga, the documentary film. It's currently being sold, I guess is the word, or advertised over on Kickstarter. Mm-hmm. So they have 18 days to go. They've raised $17,523 with a goal of $25,000. So I know we've talked about Kickstarter, and I'm still behind on getting my own Kickstarter going for a book. So basically, they, you know, if they reach their goal, then they get all the money that was pledged to them. So their $25,000 should be able to make a pretty decent documentary, huh? By, I guess, amateurs. So anyway, this is the documentary for the Amiga. And so Earl, being a big Commodore person, were you into the Amiga too?
Into the Amiga, and even back in the day, it was tough to find them. I mean, you know, I was a big Commodore fan of 8-bit, and the Amigas just weren't marketed well enough. I didn't even know where to go buy one. But ironically, now I'm getting more into the Amiga with my own Amiga, and I would love to see them make this film because it would be the Amiga was really forward-looking. A lot of the technology was ahead of its time. A lot of the people, from what I understand, were very intriguing. I hope they hit the milestone.
Yeah, me too. I'm going to see, there's 18 days ago. I think I can swing I'd like to go ahead and do the $35 one, because then you're buying a copy too of the finished DVD with the extras disc. So I mean, you're helping them out, but then of course you get a product. You know, you're getting it. So I'd like to do that.
If you do $600 or more, they'll come and do a private screening for you.
Yeah, no one's done that yet.
But only the continental U.S. Otherwise, of course, I would have done it.
But look at the 1,000 level. Someone bought that. But you got an Amiga 500 signed by Dave Haney, Andy Finkel, and Jeff Porter, and even more Amiga engineers yet to come. It's currently in my possession. Oh, and then you also get a DVD and extras and stuff. But so in Kickstarter, though, you know, they have a $20 level where you're just listed as a patron and benefactor. But you can do as little as $1, where you just say, "Yeah, I want to." You know, this is cool. I want to help him out. I'm not that into it or whatever. You know, throw him a buck. So, all right. So I'm looking forward to that. And I was never a big Amiga person, but I love documentaries especially. And so I'd love to see this. All right. So moving along, what's next here? The California Extreme Vintage Video Game and Pinball Expo.
Yeah, I pitched this into the mix. Clearly, okay. I'm on a vintage video game kick, no surprise. This one I won't be able to go to. It's in California. It's going to take place from July 9th to 10th, so that should be after this podcast comes out. It's at the Hyatt Regency in Santa Clara.
Yeah,
and
check that out.
And it's essentially a big, big gathering for pinball machines and vintage video games. A lot of the ones that come there are for sale. So it's if you're interested in picking up something like that, you can go and play it and purchase the actual machine.
Wow.
Every machine there, and it looks like there's going to be hundreds of them, are all on total free play. So if you show up, it's just the entire time that you're there, everything is available for free to play. So that's pretty cool. So it's sort of like a big swap meet and video game, like old-fashioned arcade.
That is great.
At a massive scale, and also a lot of it is for sale, so you can play a game. So I totally love this pinball machine and pick it up and take it home. So,
and you know what?
Looks really fun.
If you look at the website caextreme.com, and at the top is the banner, you know, with a picture there, and right dead in the middle are at least two, maybe it's a third one on the backside, but I think these are the original Atari Space War, I guess, video arcade terminals. Really weird 60s sort of looking. Do you know what I'm talking about? Are you guys looking at it?
I'm looking at it right now.
And yeah, I mean,
holy cow, when I look at this picture, I just want to be there. I want to go to there very badly. It looks
those
really
pinball cool. machines, can you imagine how loud it is in there? Oh, in the video
like
games.
Like an arcade should be.
So yeah.
Anyway, it's not, I mean, considering that everything there is on total free play, it goes for the whole weekend. It's a Saturday and Sunday. It's $40 for one of the days, I think, and $30 to attend the other, and $60
yeah.
for if you do the whole weekend. And it's cheaper for kids if they're, in fact, either half price or free or something like that if they're under a certain age and with an adult. And so anyway, it looks like a really fun event, like a fun way to spend the weekend, just immersed in old video games.
Yeah. Sounds good.
So if you're in the Santa Clara area, I would suggest that's what you should do on that weekend because it looks totally fun. I would, if I was closer or could get down there, I would totally go to this.
All right. Sounds great. I wish there was more stuff like that in my area.
Mm-hmm.
I'll have to make it happen.
I wish I just had a room like this that was mine. I see this and I just drool.
So let's see, the next item was recently in the news, you know, in retro computing sort of news. I know I saw stuff tweeted about it and so on. So it was an Apple II concert, and I believe the person was asking for people to let them borrow Apple IIs, right?
Yes, it was. There was Jason Torchinsky,
yeah.
That was his name. Yeah, he wrote a 16-step sequencer for the Apple II and was looking for people to donate for the evening, not permanently, but donate for the evening vintage Apple IIs because they'd all hook together and he would use them as part of the sequencer and just incorporate them into the concert. And they were saying they weren't even sure what it was going to sound like, but it was sort of a musical experiment and it looked like a really fun event.
In the picture, the guy's got like an Apple II that looks like an electric guitar. And I wonder, I mean, do you think that's Photoshopped or do you think he really did that as a prop?
Who knows, but I think it looks awesome.
It looks pretty cool.
Yeah, they were saying how on the site it was something along the lines of they weren't sure what it sounded like. It may sound like a being serenaded by a truckload of R2-D2s because it was all square wave stuff instead of chiptunes. Rather than sound chip based because it's Apple IIs, right? So who knows what this is going to sound like. I haven't heard much about the event after the fact. I wish I had known about it early enough to talk about it last show because we could have promoted people to go there and bring their Apple IIs to be incorporated, but I'd love to hear how it went. If anybody's listening and wants to write in, they could tell us if they attended how it went.
See, where was it? I just went off the webpage. Where was it again?
It was in
America
somewhere. I don't know. I vaguely lump it all together.
Oh, LA. Los Angeles. Yep. Okay.
Oh, yeah. 1200 North Alvarado, Los Angeles. Something called the Machine Project was in charge of this thing.
A storefront space. Okay. All right, Coolio. Next up is about a Space Invaders watch that was featured in Business Insider. Retro video games get posh. Romain Jerome Space Invaders watch. And trying to get the load here. Huh. Mine's not loading a picture or whatever. Do you guys have it?
I don't have that one, but I remember reading about it. I don't know if the watch is actually out yet. I think Boing Boing also picked it up. So if people were to Google it, they could probably find it. I don't think it's a functional Space Invaders game. It's simply a watch using a Space Invaders theme to it. Like, so when you look on the watch face, it's all in color, though. So I think that's a little strange. But and a really interesting sort of neat-looking watch. So just as an idea for somebody who's got a I suspect it's very expensive, so somebody who's got a lot of disposable income and wants to show off their retro fandom.
They said in there it was a luxury item.
Yeah, that just means expensive.
Oh, the light box, and you placed a watch inside of it. There are no doors, it's a peephole. It illuminates the loom of the dial. That sounds kind of odd, huh?
It does, but it's a thing. You know, there's lots of gadgets out there. I would prefer a little Space Invaders game I could play on a watch, but for something like that, maybe one of the... there could be a Space Invaders game on one of the like iPod Nanos that goes on a watch. Like something like that would be, in my opinion, a little more fun. But it's still, it was a cool looking watch. So
it's kind of what's kind of funny about this article is so the guy that wrote it, Ariel Adams, it says is a well-known wristwatch expert and gadget enthusiast. Okay, and then even at the end of his article, he says, I don't know all the details, but to sum it up, there was quite a confusion as to what type of watch was going to be made. It's like, shouldn't you kind of get some details maybe before you write an article? But I know we don't have all the details either, so it's okay.
Now, I do know there is an actual Space Invaders watch. So there is a different from this. You can get a watch that it looks like a 1980s digital watch, and it has a red LED face or something and actually plays Space Invaders. So if somebody's more interested, I've just found it online, and there is actually a playable it was limited to 500 editions though, so, and it sold in Japan for $207 when it first came out, so don't know how hard it'd be fun to get now because it came out in 2009, but that would be out there for collectors if you're looking.
Okay, next up is something that I acquired just this week, and I wanted to mention it because it's very cool, and the guy who sells them, and I guess he didn't originally produce them, but he supports them, and he's the singular person that sells them. His name's John Woodall. He lives in South Carolina. He is like the go-to Apple Lisa guy. And he lives in, like I say, South Carolina. His company's called Vintage Micros, and he sells regularly on eBay. So let me go to the link here. Basically, one of my favorite old computers and a computer that got me into the hobby was the Apple Lisa. So I've owned a few of them, and some didn't work and so on. But so I have one that's in really nice condition, works very well, doesn't have an internal hard drive. I have a profile hard drive, which has gone south, the mechanical Seagate hard drive in there. So there's other ways that you could try to make it boot or replace the drive. Believe it or not, these old Seagate hard drives, try to find one that works. They can go, people sell them for like $200 and stuff. And then how long is it going to last? So anyway, this item is called the X Profile, or the Profile Widget Emulator Board for Apple Lisa and Apple III. And it is not cheap. It's $370. So it's a specialized, you know, circuit board, and it takes a flash card. And so basically, this emulates the interface, you know, parallel interface to a Lisa or Apple III, and the Lisa sees it as a profile hard drive. And so I have one of these mounted in a case now. And in fact, I'm going to be trying it out for the first time today at the meeting with the guys here of the Atlanta Historical Computing Society. And I can boot the MacWorks Plus environment, which makes it like a Mac, which is what my original Lisa was. Or I can boot the Lisa Office system, you know, Lisa OS.
And cool. Then,
yeah, and I can swap out these environments. And obviously, this is something that will be reliable. I mean, the Lisa is going to fail one day. It's inevitable. But looks like it's got some good time left to it. The power supply doesn't jitter or anything. So hopefully I'll get, you know, lots of years of reliable, you know, playing around with it.
Nice.
So I wanted to promote it. It's very cool. Again, it's a little pricey. It took me a while, you know, save some money and stuff. He's got four more available on the site right now. So, you know, if you're a big fan of Lisa and you want to be able to really sit down and do some things with it reliably, this is something to be considered.
Mm-hmm.
And
I've never even heard of that before.
I hadn't either till there's like some other solution too, and I don't remember what it's called. And I think it allows you to interface it allows you to take a regular IDE hard drive and interface it to the Lisa, and then you can replace your profile with that and put the operating system and stuff on there. But I felt this is obviously a better solution for the long run because it's flash based.
Right. There's a few similar things in the Apple II world. Mm-hmm. Drive replacements that started off as IDE replacements and then became CF cards and that kind of stuff. And that whole movement, I think, is fantastic.
Yeah.
That people are doing this. And this is fundamentally one of the most important things to happen in retro computing if we want to extend the life of these retro devices and actually using them. So I think like all these sorts of things are just amazing, and amazing that people are developing them and that they're available.
Yeah, I agree. And that's, and obviously, well, I'm not going to say, you know, not all media is going to fail forever and people could reduplicate it and so on, but magnetic media is going to become mm-hmm. more and more troublesome moving forward. And, you know, hopefully you can keep your old machines kind of running longer. So yeah, it just, the more that we get this flash-based stuff going for older machines, the better. And then you kind of get to, you know, have hands on the real machine, and let the software, you know, it's just let the software behind the scenes, you know, so, you know, okay, it comes off a flash card versus a mechanical floppy or hard drive or whatever.
See, we never should have moved away from punch cards. That whole yeah. movement was a mistake.
I've been saying it.
I'm with you on that one, totally.
Okay, let's see. There's one last item on here. Basically, I'm just going to mention it real quick. And let's see, what is it? This is, you know, fairly related to us. We spoke about it on the show before. So this is a link to Adam Savage, who is from the MythBusters show. And he's a more vocal, you know, talks more guy. so not the guy with the big mustache and bald. What's that guy's name offhand? You guys know? The other guy? Anyway. Anyway, he does a quick segment. This is from Make Magazine and Maker's Faire, and he's basically talking about the maker movement. And I brought it up before how I kind of think the maker hackers scene movement that's going on now with Arduinos and other stuff, it parallels a lot the homebrew movement before PCs came about. It's just a very exciting. Anyway, just what I'm going to do is after the end credits for our show, I'm going to play the audio from this.
Nice.
So you can stay on the podcast and listen to it, or you can go to the show notes and go watch it, you know, and listen
to
it.
Nice way to trick people into listening to the credits. Well played.
Yeah. So I think what he has to say is very inspirational. It's really great. He talks about how, like, shop class had been dropped from high schools, and just there's not as much emphasis on this, but yet the sort of people on their own have, you know, brought up this movement of hacking, and hacking in a good way, you know, and what's the word I'm looking for? Like
modding?
Modding, pimping. Yeah. So the whole modding and modifying things. Yeah, pimping. All right. So moving on, let's just quickly go over to last auctions. So the first one was mine, a Tandy acoustic coupler, mm-hmm. which, you know, I haven't looked at these since last show. Oh, it did not sell. Oh. Is it still going? What is this?
What is this?
I think it relisted, didn't it?
That's interesting that bidding is in it on this item. Okay. No, it didn't sell for $16. That's a shame. I don't see where it's relisted.
Oh, okay. I thought, was that yours, Carrington, that relisted?
Yeah, mine relisted, but we're not supposed to talk about it yet. I'm later.
Sorry.
Okay. And then next one I did too, because I did one that was far more expensive than that one. So this one is still $150. Buy it now, and so I'm not real surprised it hasn't sold. So next is, Earls, you did a Sun Spark Station 10.
I was so irritated when I saw the price that sold at.
Oh,
I might have bought it. I might have bought it at that price.
Yeah, look, it'll only be $30 to ship to me.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and that is a real piece of history right mm-hmm. there. So I think
sold for a bargain. Somebody got a steal on that.
Somebody did, and I'm very happy for them.
Yeah.
It looked like it was
really. I'm just jealous. I'm very petty that way, though.
I want the sellers a little frustrated, you know?
You hope it fails the day they get it, right?
I mean, figure, they relist it, and then you buy it, and it works.
You know, spend 2 hours wrapping the thing up, packing, you know, taking it to the post office, doing all the stuff, and I made $10. But, you know,
go on a T-shirt.
As long as it went to somebody, you know, that appreciate it, because I know I hate throwing anything out. So then, let's see, Carrington's was the Apple IIe to 2GS upgrade,
which
LMD
did not
motherboard.
Sell. And it was an auction that had been relisted,
and he's relisted
it has
it
been
again.
Relisted again, so it's going to stay up there. And I mean, well, it's sort of expensive. I think I don't think it's outrageously expensive. Plus, it's coming with a 4 meg card as well, and so you get quite a bit for it. I'm tempted to purchase it myself, frankly. But
well, and he's got it where you can make offers. So obviously, 500's maybe a little too high, but yeah, it'd be interesting to follow. So we can we should try to check back on that one, on the new one, and see what happens. All right, so moving on to the current auctions, let's go with you, Carrington. Another Apple II related surprise.
A shocker for everyone. I stayed with the Apple II. This is an 18.75 megahertz.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Transwarp.
Transwarp GS. So the Transwarp GSs actually came, I think it was 6.25 or 7 megahertz. But a company called Reactive Micro used to offer an upgrade to them, and they wouldn't all make it. It's, you know, that's quite a bit of overclocking to go from 6.25 up to 18.75, so three times. So they changed the oscillator. They'd have to add active cooling to it, like a whole bunch of things, and many times they would fail. This is one of the ones that survived and has continued to work, and so now it's being sold. A fellow named James Littlejohn, who I actually met the first time I went to Kansas Fest. Really good guy. And I think he's selling this in part to fund his return to Kansas Fest this year. And he comes in a big green bus. So really interesting guy. Drives this massive bus and down to Kansas Fest. So I'm hoping he sells it, especially if he needs to fund him going back to Kansas Fest, because I'd love to meet him again. So this is the fastest way to get a vintage Apple II. Like, you can't get a faster vintage Apple II than this. Like, you'll have 18.75 megahertz Apple II GS, screamingly faster than a stock machine.
Funny, too, how an 18 megahertz, mm-hmm. you're absolutely right, is screaming. But, you know, in relative to a modern, 4 gigahertz, it just seems crazy.
multiple core, multiple millions of hertz computer nowadays, or billions, or but compared to like a 1 megahertz machine, this is 18.75 times faster. So really it's just held back by the media now, reading drives and stuff. But if you're using a vintage Apple II for things other than games, like for things like word processing and that kind of stuff, surfing the net with an Ethernet card, for instance, this is the sort of thing that will turn a vintage computer into something very usable in a modern context. So I'm very tempted by this one myself, actually. It has currently, I think it's been bid up to $100, but it hasn't met its reserve, and it does also have a buy it now.
$750. I wonder what the reserve is.
It's expensive buy it now, but the $100 would have been a complete steal, so I'm not surprised that that's below the reserve. So we'll see if it goes. I'm hoping it does.
I always liked the boxes for Applied Engineering, because they had they liked to tout how Steve Wozniak gave a thumbs up, I think, to them, right? Wasn't that always on the box?
Sure. And the reality is the Transwarp GS, I have a standing search in eBay for it, mm-hmm. and they rarely come up in any format, stock or otherwise, and they always sell. As a stock one, will sell for far over $100. So the fact that this hasn't met its reserve is not unreasonable, because you can't pick up one of any speed, let alone something that's been overclocked three times and has remained stable.
Mm-hmm. So he should be patient. Mm-hmm. He's got 6 days to go. So
Which is in time for Kansas Fest. So I'm hoping somebody purchases it. It might be me, and that it helps him get to Kansas Fest, because he's a good guy, and this is a great product. So
All right, well, moving on to our oral year auction, the Wyze, WY185 VT320 like terminal.
And going to the Seattle Retro Computing Society last week and seeing all the big mainframes, I guess, got me in a mainframe mood. There's always been a mystique with terminals, back in my college days, you could either go to the computer lab and wait in line, but if you were one of the ones who had a terminal and a modem, you'd hook up from home. And, then you're in the comfort of your own home doing your programming. I never had that. And it's like, I always wanted a terminal. I still would like to have a terminal that I could connect up to, say, a CPM system or even a Linux box, whatever. Just the mystique of having, the dumb box sitting there and connected up to the awesome computer in the sky. So I was looking on eBay for a terminal, and this one came up, and a couple things were noteworthy, I thought, about this particular auction, that it looked like it was in good shape, without burn-in, functional, and even though it's a Wyze, which is a good name in terminals, the thing that caught my eye was that it emulated a DEC VT320, which would facilitate the use of it with older systems or older mm-hmm. software. So anyway, and again with the Amber, you gotta love the Amber.
Yeah, I always like the Amber. What now the standard you mentioned, the DEC 320 or whatever, or VT320? What was the later standard then?
Oh, I don't know that answer.
Okay. There's been a bunch, but the 320 is very supported. So like that's if you're going to have a terminal, that's a great way to go.
But isn't there like one other, I don't know, that's what I'm asking. Isn't there another that standard that's kind of the more common one you hear about? Or, whoa. Did you fall back?
No, it may have been me pushing things around. Maybe.
And with that question, Carrington falls out of his chair.
We have a Carrington down.
Carrington down. Carrington down. okay, well, I don't know a lot about terminals. I was trying to think.
The more common deck standard that I'm used to seeing actually is like VT-100.
There you go. There you go. That's
VT-100, VT-102. Yeah.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking.
Exactly.
Right.
The VT-320 is a more capable model, you know, in terms of more codes and more.
Right. And there was the VT-52 and just straight ANSI and a lot of things. And,
exactly.
But the 320 is a great way to go. So this looks like a good item. Mm-hmm.
I added to the show notes. Yeah, very cool. So it's a buy it now for $55. It's got 5 days left. It would be $55 to ship to me because it is in, doesn't say. Random computer blitz or bits, the person. But I added to the show notes, Earl and Carrington. But if you notice there, a guy named Brad, who's the vice president of the Atlanta Historical Computer Society, coming over today, he recently showed me in his job that he got this program called the Wyze Pocket Cloud for the iPad, where he's a systems administrator, and he was able to, do his stuff from the iPad, but using a Bluetooth keyboard where he hadn't been able to do some of those things. So as soon as you said a Wyze terminal, it made me think of that.
I think Wyze is still in the game.
They're still around.
The last product that I had purchased for them was one of these, like a Win terminal, where it runs a little embedded version of Windows and you use it to connect up to like a Citrix system or a Windows remote desktop system. And they're really cool and they're small and, so it's kind of like a thin client.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Okay, last up then is my auction I chose. And so I think appropriately because of my Lisa been on the mind here lately is I chose an Apple Lisa. So it says rare Apple Lisa 210 computer restored, fully working. It's got a standard or starting bid rather of $999. No bids on it. It's got 2 days to go. Buy it now at $1,495. $175 shipping, which that seems about right, I guess, to me, depending on where the guy is. But it looks to be in very nice condition. It's got a matching original image writer. It boots. It's got the real Lisa operating system on it. Kind of high, but I think this is kind of the going prices for these recently. You know, the Lisas, as I've followed them over the years, at different times, you could pick up a really nice one for between $400 and $600, typically. I mean, if it booted and it was clean and decent and stuff. And then now, apparently, I looked at the history. You can't touch one for under like $1,000 all of a sudden again.
Wow, interesting.
And then this one, of course, the person's hoping to get as much as $1,500. So, anyway, a nice one if you're looking for a nice, clean Lisa. This guy's got good feedback.
I wish he had a picture. It shows a lot of pictures of the monitor. I always like with something with CRT to see a picture of the monitor turned off so you can see the extent of burn-in, if any. That would be my only question about this one. It's a good-looking box, though.
It's got the original keyboard. Now, I noticed scrolling down, it has a – not a big deal, but it does not have a Lisa mouse, which, if you – depending on how much of a Lisa purist you want to be. And I'm not clear on this. I believe some of the later Lisas, when they actually became Mac XLs, I think they came with the Mac mouse. Do you guys know what I'm talking about? The Lisa mouse, slightly different shaped and had a thinner rectangular button.
Mm-hmm. I didn't know that some of them came with the Mac mouse. This one here distinctly looks like the early Mac mouse.
Yeah, and also if you look at the picture where it shows the back where the mouse is plugged in, see the gigantic turn screws on it? That's definitely an original Mac mouse. But yeah, that's my wife's showing me that Lisa mouse. That's a real Lisa mouse, and I have the box for it. Yeah, really nice, though, otherwise. Oh, wait, does it have a – oh, look, it has an internal – yeah, this is definitely a Mac XL because it's got the internal hard drive in it. Very clean. All right, let's move along then. We're doing good on time. So last, we're just going to move into saying goodbye.
Goodbye.
So, Carrington, what do you got going on? We said hello, now we say goodbye.
Now I say hello. retro computing-wise, very little. Last night I did a 1 megahertz episode, so that will
good.
Have to edit it today, and we'll see if we can get that cleaned up and get it out. We'll see. Sometimes it's 2 weeks before I finally get it out. There's been a postal strike here in Canada, and so a fellow that won – like when I review software, I'll then give it away in the cartoon head cookie jar. And the fellow who won the stuff from – not even the last row, I think the one before, it's still not in his hands because I sent it, I had an incorrect postage and it came back to me, and then I went to send it again and Canada Post was on strike. So, but the strike is now ended, so I'm going to send it out to him and include another piece of software in his little "sorry, it took me a month to get this to you" bonus. So.
Didn't I hear on Double Take, did you say that Sherry Creamer, she's going to also be on the 1 megahertz?
Yeah, we have been playing, in fact, she's coming over. We've played two sessions already. Looks like we'll have one more to finish it. We're playing a game called Police Quest.
Right.
I've got that hooked up on the TV, and so she comes over, and we're playing Police Quest together. And with my friend Rachel and I, we played one of the King's Quest games as well. So I've already got that one in the can, as it were. So that will be, I think, not next episode, but the one after that will have the King's Quest one. A lot of these bits get recorded way in advance of shows. So, but yeah, today or tomorrow, we'll be finishing up the Police Quest game, which has been really fun. And we've been calling each other Hot Pencil because of it. There's a guy in it who gets called Hot Pencil. Keep on jamming, Hot Pencil. So it's become my favorite slang with her. So yeah. Totally fun.
Cool. Looking forward to it.
Mm.
So, Earl, what do you got going on?
Man.
You got all kinds of great clubs to be a part of.
I'm telling you, the retro stuff is just on a high ebb, you know, on the biorhythm here. If there was a retro biorhythm, I'm like up at the top. So the Seattle meeting that we talked about and the retro challenge stuff that I'm doing with the PX8. Also, the Commodore Computer Club last night in Vancouver, Washington, where I brought a Commodore 128 and I showed off a variety of programming environments for the 128. So I had the Buddy 128 assembler, which is a really cool assembler where you can easily mix BASIC and assembly code, and it uses the standard BASIC line editor. It's awesome. A BASIC 8, which is a high-res graphics version of BASIC for the 128. Also Turtle Graphics that I was mentioning my daughter's doing some programming in, and Super C 128. So you could, you know, get your C coding on. So
now these different environments, this is you're speaking of like you're booting it as a C128 and then running these different things in it. Is that right?
Well, all these were packages that run on the Commodore 128, and they have different ways of doing your coding. Like I say, the Buddy assembler, you can just use the standard BASIC line editor. It's really interesting how it does that.
Do you know what I mean? Like, in other words, you're not booting it in the Commodore 64 mode, and you're not booting it.
No.
CPM machine. So this is running as the standard C128 BASIC mode or whatever.
So the BASIC 8 and the Buddy and the Super C, they're all 128, they actually take advantage of the 128. The Turtle Graphics is a Commodore 64 package, so we got to, you know, crank it into compatibility mode to run that. I also brought Turbo Pascal, which runs on the Commodore 128 in CPM mode.
Oh, okay. All right.
So yeah, four or five different ways to program it. It was fun, you know, dusting those off. And you know, after you don't play with something for a little while, you're kind of like, how do you do that again? And so I had to refresh my own mind and then showing other people. So that was great. So lots of retro stuff going on. Also, in Seattle last weekend, we went to a place called RePC, which is a recycled PC goods kind of store. You find all kinds of little, you know, treasures there. And one thing I found was a full box set of Novell NetWare 3.12, including all the discs and the books in brand new shape, brand new condition. I used to be a NetWare system administrator like way back in the late 80s. So, you know, seeing the red books again, you know, the Novell red, that was just really cool. So I picked it up for $5.
Another industry that Microsoft stomped on, huh?
Yeah, Novell really did get steamrolled. But, man, back in the day, they were the stuff. Yeah. If you wanted a LAN, you know, that was the way to go.
I administered one as well for about a year and a half.
Yeah, so that was an awesome find, and you know, been playing around with that. So tons of stuff.
The first Netscape, you know what I mean? Because Microsoft, you know, pretty much came in and took, you know, because they dominated that part of the industry, and then Microsoft pretty much stomped them.
And I remember in the company I was working for at the time, we were deciding what to go with for a PC network operating system. We had three choices. It was Windows NT, Novell NetWare, or using some of the tools that would let you have Unix be your network operating system for a PC. And we're a Unix shop, you know, big Unix, so that was compelling, but they were just too clunky. And you could even see the handwriting on this is like 95, you could even at that point see the handwriting on the wall that, you know, Microsoft was going to take the prize. So that's what we went with. They're still running it, basically, you know, the latest versions of it. So Yeah, interesting times. But and
I'm not as familiar with it, but I think once NT 3.5 or something or 3 came out, that was really the kind of, that was when things definitely were leaning now into the Microsoft camp, right? That was like 93 or something, maybe.
That, yeah, 3.51, and you're right. That's when the things started to turn the corner.
Yeah, my eldest brother Michael was also a Novell administrator for a real big Novell guy. I had the certification and all that for a long time. Well, cool. I would love to see, again, I love documentaries, even about things that maybe, I just like documentaries, but especially classic computing stuff, but I would love to see a documentary about Novell. I think that'd be very interesting to learn.
That would be
learn
fascinating.
More about,
somebody should do that.
Yeah, the rise of the company and in the fall, you know. All right, well, lastly, so to talk about what I'm up to is, so as I mentioned, in just about 30 minutes here, I've got Du Bois coming over for the Atlanta Historical Computing Society. So things are starting to take off. I'm really happy about that. So that's good news for Southeast History of Computing region. But also I wanted to mention, and I know I'd emailed you guys, that I was involved in a movie project that was really exciting. And so I have a quick story to tell. I was contacted by a young producer-director who was from the L.A. area, so, you know, Hollywood. And he's in film school there, graduate school, I think. He's doing a short film. Came to Atlanta to film it because things are just so much cheaper to do so here. And he also it was so expensive to rent, like, office space, because the majority of the films are filmed in, like, a typical office space with cubicles and stuff. No pun intended about the movie Office Space. But, so he came to Atlanta. He was looking for an old computer. A seminal part or an important part of the film is this old computer. So it's sort of a Twilight Zone sort of a story. So he originally was asking for Carrington. He had mentioned the Apple II.
Hooray.
Which I think would be fine. But then I said, hey, the Apple II is great. You know, I think in what reading your script, it seems to me that a singular computer, an all-in-one type computer, might be easier. Because, you know, for the guy, when it's supposed to be delivered, it's just you lift up this one unit. Mm-hmm. Plus, I said, you know, the Apple II was just featured recently in the show Lost, and it's a little more well-known. And so I think the TRS-80 Model 3 would be kind of cool looking. It's lesser known. It's silver. It looks really retro-y, you know, really old-fashioned, I think. Not that the Apple II doesn't. Anyway, cut the chase. So basically, I was involved in this over a weekend and a couple other days in the evenings. I made my own little documentary of the filming, so I have a link in the show notes. It's about 20 minutes. I don't expect everybody to watch the whole thing, but at least go in about a third and watch the scene where, like, the guy, the computer's delivered, and definitely watch the last couple of minutes. So in a nutshell, I mean, I guess it kind of spoils it, but until you see the real film, which I don't know if everybody will have the opportunity. Essentially, this computer, the guy finds that he can delete things with it, and ultimately, at the very end, he deletes everything. So he essentially
basically.
He should have backed us up.
He essentially reboots the universe. But just a quick story about the computer. So I had a TRS-80 Model 3 I'd had for a while, and it worked. And cleaned it up and I wrote a basic little program. And there's a scene in the where I filmed the scene. You know, we're just showing this. It looks kind of like a matrix screen of just text and stuff. So got it all, you know, working where it'll boot the TRS-DOS and then run this little basic program. Well, over the period of a couple of days, the disk drive just got less and less reliable, where ultimately it wouldn't boot anymore. And they did all these scenes, and so now they need to film the screen, and it wouldn't boot. And it just so happened a lady locally had given me another one, but the first time I tried it, it didn't do anything. Power light would come on, but it wouldn't do anything. So I messed with it and got it to work. So cleaned it up, adjusting the screen. And so, you know, did the little basic thing again. It's been on 30 or 40 minutes. My little office I'm in here is across from the dining room. So it's over there on the dining room table. Been on 30 or 40 minutes. I'm over here checking email, doing their stuff. This is like 11 o'clock at night, you know. Oh, thank goodness. I can take this computer tomorrow and they can film the screen. All of a sudden I hear this loud pop.
Oh.
And all this stinky white smoke starts pouring out of the top of it. And I look over and it's still on. And I run over and I yank the cord out of the wall, and I call my wife down, and we open the windows, and we're trying, you know, get all the stinky smell out.
So
we finally open it up, and it was a big sort of wafer style capacitor that blew, and I was a little paranoid about it, but we cleaned it all up and plugged it back in, and the thing still works. and you know and the fact that it had still worked when it popped, I kind of, after thinking about it, I thought, you know, maybe it was a bug. Maybe there's some bug that was in there, and it heated up to the point where its body exploded. Because if it blew a component, it, certainly it wouldn't work anymore.
No, yeah, it could. If it was a filtering capacitor or something like that, it could still function.
Yeah, so it still works. Now it works fine.
So, yeah. The nice thing about that is those kind of things are replaceable.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's going to be a project of mine to replace it. But when I took it back to the office and, you know, to have it filmed or whatever, I said, look, I'm not real paranoid about this because I had it on at least another hour and I stayed real close to it. But while it's on, I'm going to stay right here next to it. And could you get a fire extinguisher and keep it right over here? Because, you know, I would hate...
It probably made that feel very comfortable, yeah. Actually.
But I told him the story. It's like, you know, but if the thing did pop and catch on fire or whatever, then, you know, then how would I feel?
I don't know. I would want to get it on film. I would figure a way to work that into the script.
And you know, and I so wish
absolutely
when it had popped, I so wish I had I could have grabbed a video camera and filmed that. You know, the smoke coming out of it and everything. So anyway, that's what's going on with me.
That's hilarious.
I just have to know, David, just one question. When you say he rebooted the universe, when the universe reboots, do you hear that Macintosh bing?
No, he does it in such a way where, and of course, I haven't seen the final film's not done, but according to the script, and I wrote the little screen code where in BASIC just where it'll display this. It I think he reboots it. It goes to black. I think he's gonna have graphics sort of like the Big Bang and all that. And then I think it's gonna at some point meld in or cross fade into like the screen again, where it comes up with something like reinitializing, or in other words, where the computer is rebooting or the code, and then of course that's what's made the universe reboot. And you know, so I haven't seen any of the post production stuff. But it's very exciting, and I think it's a pretty decent little short film. It's pretty neat to be involved in it. So anyway, so everybody check it out. It's cool. Plus, you can see some behind the scenes of a little movie production.
Awesome.
Awesome. Totally awesome.
All right. Guys, have a great 4th of July. Carrington, have a good 4th of July.
I just had a great 4th of July for Canada Day.
Yeah, Canada Day. And you know what? What is Canada Day, Carrington? Because I'm ignorant
first,
about it.
The 1st of July. You guys copied us a couple days later.
No, I know it because, again, we have an office in Toronto, so I knew that our Toronto folks were off yesterday. But
yeah,
what is Canada Day, what is it about as far as your national holiday?
The exact same. It's the birth of Confederation. It's Canada, the formation of Canada.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What year did that happen in?
1987.
No.
So July 1st, really. So you just wanted to upstage us by 3 days, right?
Yep. Yeah. On the East Coast, they still sort of deny that it happened at all for some, but for the most part, I like to think of it as basically around the time I got out of high school, Canada said, oh, sure, we'll exist formally.
So it's when you were no longer a province of the UK or whatever, a territory, but your own country. I'll have to look into that.
You know, I'm not sure we're going to get a straight answer at Carrington. We're going to have to wait.
No, it was 1867.
The Queen is not amused. All right, guys. Have a good weekend.
Yeah, you too. Have a fun meeting, David.
Thanks a lot. I appreciate it. It was a fun show. See you later.
See ya.
That's a wrap. Thanks everyone for listening and supporting the show. Please check out the discuss links in the show notes. If you're a fan of the show, please do two things. First, we'd love to hear about it, so email the show at rcr@classiccomputing.com. Also, help us by rating us and submitting a review on iTunes, so more people will find us. Until next time, Retro Compute.
What is it about Meg that you find appealing?
Meg seems to me to fit this perfect mold of teaching people that it's safe to learn new things. I mean, it describes some very complex things, but I've never found the way it describes how to do things to be beyond my ability to comprehend. And I've read a lot of articles and a lot of stuff online when I'm researching new ideas or new projects. And Meg really has figured out the methodology that makes the process accessible.
You know, we talk so much in this country about the STEM crisis.
Yeah.
it seems to me that there's some idea here. There's a German idea for getting kids enthused about this subject matter. What do you think?
Well, you know, I feel like the whole Maker movement and Mythbusters have come of age simultaneously in this really lovely way. And the clear message is that if you teach people how to do things, you teach people to do things with science and technology, they do. And kids find it most exciting of all. And, you know, 15 years ago, we were thinking, well, no one's ever going to be able to hack something the way they used to hack their cars. And now that's totally not true. Now people are cracking open their cell phones and adding new features with their own soldering iron. I mean, that's amazing.
What really is behind it all, do you think?
I feel kind of like the resurgence has to do with exactly the same impetus that caused the post-war culture to take on modifying cars. And so cars were at a certain stage in their technology in the 50s where everyone all of a sudden could open up the hood and start to modify. And I feel like, you know, that's probably, if you studied it, and I haven't, but if you studied it, I feel like that would be something you could encounter across any technology curve. There's a certain point where it's all magic and mystery, and there's a point where people kind of get it, and then they start to mess around with it. And so I think that's where we are with electronics, and that's one of the big, big changes.
That's an interesting point, because, you know, my assumption was that, you know, the Heathkit days were over.
Yeah.
But you're saying we're in a different era, a different wave, sort of a post-computer version of that?
Absolutely. I mean, where people are, you know, where 12-year-old kids are jailbreaking their phones to add things that the manufacturer never intended, everybody's learning. I mean, granted, there's a lot of difficulties with copyright and fair use and patent stuff like that,
right.
But all those are growing pains while people learn to talk about how they want their technology to be.
So this assumption that kids will no longer know how to make things is maybe that was a temporary phase.
I think it's a temporary thing, and I think I think right now it tends to be an ideological problem where, you know, the first thing that gets shut down is the shop class. But I think that, I mean, 100,000 people here are a clear demonstration that you put tools in front of the kids, they're going to start using them, and it's going to make their world bigger.
Well, let's talk about shop class. We don't do that anymore.
No, we
don't. And I think we lose something, don't we?
I totally think we do. I being able to drill a hole in a quarter was transformative to me when I was 14 years old. Shop classes, this is one of the saddest things that goes away. And it's the sadder thing to me is that it's probably one of the last things that'll show back up again. I think drama programs will be reinstated long before shop classes. So I get excited when I see things like the Maker Faire, Make Magazine, and Tech Shop, where I feel like Tech Shop may be the new shop class.
Well, you know, it's interesting, though. We live in an era where you get a chemistry set and there's no chemicals in it for fear of, you know, terrorism or litigation or whatever. I mean, part of what they celebrate here is embrace a little bit of the danger, right?
Absolutely.
And that's what you guys do.
It is, and we do. It's a difficult thing, embracing the danger. I understand the narrative of legal problems that lead to chemistry sets with no chemicals. At the same time, I think that we all have to take responsibility, and we all injure ourselves in our childhood learning things. There's no way you can legislate that or regulate it away. And, there will be a longer curve of people relearning that, I think.
When you come here and you see the enthusiasm that kids have for it, what this reminds us is that they have access to it. Everybody is a maker at heart at a certain stage of their lives, right?
Absolutely. Totally. I mean, you know, storytelling, just the reason we develop language is also about making. It's taking your world and making it understandable to yourself. And making is all about that. I mean, it's not about having an object in front of you that does something. No one here who's built any of this stuff will tell you, thank God I now have an electric car. They'll tell you the long and amazing story of all the things they had to get through to do it. And that's what it's about.